Hey everyone, Clay here. Schedules in life being what they are, Amanda and I have decided that we're going to take the rest of the month of May off from regular episodes. And instead, this week, we're going to give you a look at what we're doing at Patreon this year, which is we're covering sequels. And the first sequel we covered this year is Gremlins 2. So we're going to give you that one on the main feed this week. But we will be back in June. Back to our normal shenanigans with number 118 on our list, which is The Island of Lost Souls. Until then, if you can't get enough of listening to us yap, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile. Jump on board. Follow us as we do the rest of the sequels for this year and the ones we've already done. And in June, we will also be having an extra Patreon episode where Amanda and I will be recording from the Stanley Hotel in Colorado, which of course is the hotel that inspired Stephen King's The Shining. So enjoy, and we'll see you in June. Hello, welcome to the 2026 Patreon edition of the Rotten Horror Picture Show, our first episode of the new year, and boy, what a year it's been already. Can't wait for this to be over. This year, previously we had done remakes and reboots, and so this year we are doing sequels.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Clay, with me as always is Amanda. How you doing, Amanda?
I mean, I'm okay, but I thought we'd agreed that we were updating our name to the Movie Police.
Oh, yes. Yes, Movie Police. Wee, wee, wee.
Yeah.
Four lost body cam footages for this movie.
Hey.
I think it's only, I think the end of the Movie Police show should, if they don't like it, they should both shoot it with a gun.
Yeah. Like a box with the VHS tape in it or something.
Yeah, shoot the VHS with a gun and then toss a bag of cocaine at it.
Yeah.
Of course.
Put a gun in the box and say, it came at me.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Of course, that idea would not be out of the realm of possibility for our first movie of the year, which is Gremlins 2 from 1990. Yay. It's not on our main list, but it does have a 72% Rotten Tomatoes score and a 59% audience score, which sounds insane to me. This so much feels like a movie that should be the other way around, where the people really like it, but the critics don't.
Totally.
But to give you a sense of what the critics thought of this movie, the worst score was from Empire. It was a 60. It said, you can really tell that the people making this film had a lot of fun doing it. The plot is thinner than a compressed wafer. Man, I'm welcome back. Strained metaphors.
Yeah.
My favorite part.
Overly florid writing. Yes. Yeah.
The plot is thinner than a compressed wafer, but who cares? It's fun and cheap laughs all the way, and that ain't no crime. And the best is an 80 from the BBC that says the sequel to Gremlins actually proves more enjoyable than the first film, offering audacious dark humor and a lot of knowing in jokes. So
knowing in jokes.
Knowing in jokes. In jokes is half the battle. Had you seen this before? I'm assuming you have.
Yes. Yes, definitely. I'm trying to remember. I feel like we watched it not that long ago.
We watched Gremlins 1, I believe, during COVID. I think that's when we covered Gremlins 1. And we watched
I think we watched it during COVID, and then like 2 years later we covered it.
Is that really?
Yeah.
that you might be right. I can't honestly can't remember. But regardless,
I'm like 99% sure that we watched Gremlins 1 like 2020 and then again in like 2024.
I mean there is an easy way for me to find out, isn't there? Well, I will look
it doesn't up. It doesn't matter that much, but yeah, I know I've watched this.
Well, I remember
like at some point.
I remember we watched the first Gremlins as part of our group COVID movie watch, and then yes. I'm pretty sure my wife and I at least immediately watched Gremlins 2 afterwards.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was the same time as you.
That might have been what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. What is your history with Gremlins 2? Was that the first time you'd seen it, or is this a movie you've seen a number of times?
I think whenever in the last, say, 6 years I watched it, I think it was the first time I had sat down and watched it all the way through and not just seen, like, bits and pieces here and there. And mm-hmm. I was deeply overwhelmed by it.
Fair.
as a film. It throws a lot at you.
Sure does.
And I remember feeling kind of mixed the first time I watched it.
Okay.
Because I think I really like the darker tone of the original.
Sure, yeah.
Like where it is a little more of a horror movie, but I think upon watching this again, there's a lot to appreciate in this movie.
Yeah, for me this was one of those movies that I watched a number of times without having seen the first one. So this was right in the pocket of when I started watching movies a lot with my cousin, who is a year older than me. And mm-hmm. I like the group of movies that I was watching a lot without mm-hmm. having seen the original at the time were Gremlins 2, Terminator 2, Nightmare on Elm Street 3. So there was a bunch of these sequels I had watched well before I had seen the original. And this was, my cousin was a huge Gremlins 2 fan, so I must have watched this movie 20 times when I was a kid.
Wow.
Yeah, it was, I remember watching Gremlins 1, and you are right, actually, Amanda. We did Gremlins mm-hmm. in 2023.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense in my brain.
Yeah. But yeah, I remember the first time I watched Gremlins, I didn't really like it that much. I think.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think because I was much more used to the over the top kind of camp mm-hmm. of the second one. And so to mm-hmm. see the first one be a lot darker and whatnot, I didn't really like it that much. And because
that's funny that we had like the opposite experience of the other person.
Yeah. I think part of it too is like Gremlins 2 it is such a full movie and it moves so fast that it's just constantly throwing stuff at you. Yes. And Gremlins mm-hmm. does too. The first one does as well eventually, but it takes much longer to get there. This one doesn't waste any time. And so I think that was part of it too. Yeah. It's a little bit more deliberate and it's a little bit more like, you know, there's town drama and stuff where
the original is like a little more of a traditional movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not so much a traditional movie.
No.
But yeah, so I'm watching the first Gremlins being like, okay, it's been 25 minutes. When is Vegetable Gremlin going to show up? And of course he doesn't.
Right.
But yeah, this was one I kind of went back and forth on it because I really liked it as a kid. And then at a certain point, mm-hmm. I thought it was one of those movies that I liked as a kid, but actually wasn't very good because I had heard a lot of people be like, oh, well, Gremlins 2. Gremlins 2 is not very good. And then as an adult, I watched Gremlins 2 again and I said, those people are insane. This movie's fantastic. Gremlins 2, my hot take is Gremlins 2 might be a perfect sequel, but we will get into that as we go. Going to play the trailer for you real quick. And then, or something. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about it.
Everybody here gets to design their own gremlin.
So you mean like, what if there was like a brainy gremlin?
You talking about a gremlin with glasses who could talk and sing New York, New York? That's brilliant. It's in the movie Done. Whoa, you said that nothing was final. That was before I heard the words brainy and gremlin in the same sentence together. It's done, I love it, it's in the movie next.
What about a spider gremlin?
You mean a gremlin with eight legs and a thorax just catching pretty ladies in a web in an office building? Oh my God, it's in the movie, I love it! Next!
What about a bat gremlin?
You mean a gremlin with leathery wings just flying around, flip-flopping, bust through a wall, make a perfect bat symbol in the wall, get outside, get in some wet concrete, jump up on a building and just dry in place like a gargoyle gremlin? We are cooking with gas now. I love it. It's in the movie next. Could there be a female gremlin? Lipstick, boobies, bitch, you have me and little gremlin vajayjay. I love it so much that it's not only in the movie, but it's definitely in the movie. There's no backseats on that one, no penny taxis. Yes, 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 in the movie, done. That's why we need a woman in the writer's room. Next.
I don't know. A googly-eyed gremlin?
But you do know, because you talk about a gremlin whose sole purpose in this film is just that he looks stupid as fuck, yes. It can be in the movie, and it is in the movie. Done. Next. What about you, Silver Fox?
Electricity gremlin?
You just said noun and gremlin, like you play in Mad Libs. You just like a child. You have the brain of a child. You do not have a high IQ, but you haphazardly came up with a gremlin that's just made out of bolts that is zigzagging all over the room and is done completely in animation. You a crazy person, and your idea's in the movie. Done. Next.
Can we put the Hulkster in it?
What? You talking about putting Hulk Hogan, professional wrestler, turned actor, turned cultural icon, in the movie where he break the fourth wall of the movie he's in by talking to the audience. You, sir, are a raging psychopath. Don't let this town take that away from you. That's it. I don't even care anymore. We got the Hulkster in this bitch, so it's done. I don't have any more time, so let me just recap right now. It's Brainy Gremlin, Spider Gremlin, Bat Gremlin, Lady Gremlin, Googly Eye Gremlin, Electricity Gremlin, Hulk Hogan's gonna be in the picture. I'm gonna throw in a gremlin myself. Vegetable Gremlin, just write it up. I'm having so much fun, thank you. It's all gonna be in the actual film. Now I gotta go put some cowboys in Back to the Future 3. Sayonara, y'all. Oops.
Okay, Gremlins 2 from 1990, directed by Joe Dante, written by Charles S. Haas, and I think Joe Dante is listed as one of the writers. He's not on IMDb, but I think he is in the actual movie. Starring in possibly the greatest collection of weirdos and character actors ever put on film. The guy from Gremlins, I say that because I don't know him from anything else. The girl from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Satan from Brimstone. Did you ever watch Brimstone? That's probably well before your time.
No.
It was a TV show that lasted one season. Oh, man, I loved it. It was about a cop who, I think he died in the line of duty or something. Anyway, he dies and he goes to hell. And while he's in hell, Satan gives him a deal that he will send him back to Earth, but he has to hunt down 16 demons that have escaped from hell, and the only way he can send them back to hell is to shoot them through the eyes.
That sounds amazing.
I loved it. It was I don't know how many episodes I actually watched, because it was one of those weird shows where it's like it only lasted a handful of episodes and they just sort of threw them out there, but it made a big impression on me. And the guy who plays Satan, John Glover, is always first in my head, Satan from Brimstone, and then everything else he's done, because he's done a million things. Satan from Brimstone, the Doctor from Voyager, Nick the movie theater guy from Last Action Hero, Saruman the White, Getty Watanabe is the same stereotype he plays in every movie, the twins from Terminator 2, Saturday Night Live's resident androgynous pal Pat, Senator Clay Davis from The Wire, Hank from Breaking Bad, Leonard Maltin, Gomez Adams, Hulk Hogan, Dick Butkus and Bubba Smith, the crazy Mexican drug guy from Breaking Bad, a cartoon opening from Chuck Jones, who came out of retirement to do it, Howie Mandel as Gizmo, Dick Miller, and the voice of Tony Randall as the brainy gremlin. Amanda.
That's quite a lineup.
What happens in Gremlins 2, The New Batch?
This might be one of my favorite movie summaries I've ever found. It's on IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
The gremlins are back And this time, they've taken control of a New York City media mogul's high-tech skyscraper.
Okay, correct, I guess.
Yep, we're going to hear nothing about any of the characters. We don't care about their lives. Just tell us what the gremlins are doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that summary is saying.
There should be a live stream camera going at all times telling us what the gremlins are doing.
Yes. My God, that would be that would crash the internet, I think. Well, Clay, some things you'll find in Gremlins 2 include...
Mm-hmm.
The Clamp Chinatown Center, where business gets oriented.
Great joke.
What are you talking about?
Inappropriate, but great joke.
What's the joke, Clay?
Business.
Business. Thinly veiled Trump parody.
Yeah, he's Clamp is kind of a mix of a few different types, but he's definitely very Trump coded.
Yes.
One of the things I was actually reading was that originally he was supposed to be more of a villain, but he kind of evolved into being kind of a good guy, and they gave all the more villainous stuff to Robert Picardo. So it's like a Trump parody in kind of name only, because he's his actual personality is very much the opposite, and also the stuff that he makes works.
I mean, some of the time.
Some of the time.
Those revolving doors didn't seem very helpful.
I do like that questionable inventions is a running gag in these movies. Because, like, the father is not in this one, but his spirit is here with these modernized, automated things that constantly have bugs and problems in them.
Do you mean the next thing you'll find in this movie? The most advanced smart building in America?
Yes, I do. It's one of the things I was not expecting is how accurate of a speculative fiction work this is. Because there's a lot of stuff in this where it's like, that's kind of how it goes now.
It's crazy because we can get into this later, but it's shocking that this kind of bullshit was applicable in, when did this come out? 1990?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 35, 36 years ago, this was already all happening. But I also kind of wonder if at the time people were like this felt a little more like it was poking fun rather than just reproducing reality.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's very
now
much.
Now it feels a little too on the nose.
Yeah. It's very much poking fun at the way things are trending, because in 1990, mm-hmm. like a lot of this stuff was just sort of peeking its head out. And it's a lot of stuff you would see on TV or for sale on a home shopping network or something like that. I actually think the most interesting bit of kind of, foresight was, mm-hmm. the cable channel itself having
that's more what I was thinking about, was the combo of like businessman running a cable channel. There's even like a side joke about Clamp having a popular line of jams and jellies,
right? Yes.
Do you know that's the stuff I think is really amazingly prescient.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, you'll also find Splice-O-Life designer jeans.
Yeah, it's what does he say? What did he want to put in there instead? Like a gym or something? But that he went in and put.
Oh,
the,
yeah. It's like we could have had two psychotherapists and a plastic surgeon or something.
Yes, but instead they picked the DNA research.
Splice-O-Life. Yeah. Casablanca now in full color with a happier ending.
Yeah, that's another joke from that is of the time, but I think still works pretty well that's a reference to Ted Turner launching a campaign to colorize classic movies. to put them on TV because he thought black and white was nobody wanted to watch black and white movies. And two of the biggest proponents against this, I guess proponent is a opponent, I guess,
were
Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, which I do find slightly ironic given that George Lucas decided to go back in and change his movies. But I guess that's his movie. He can do whatever he wants. But the other second half of this joke in the movie is at one point on one of the TVs, they're playing a colorized version of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, yeah. A chic new Canadian restaurant.
That restaurant looked incredible.
Yeah. With the chocolate mousse for dessert. Yeah.
That also, excellent joke.
Yeah, it's so stupid. I love it. And all the waiters are Mounties.
Yes. I would eat there 100%.
Really, yeah, I would too. Dick Miller's amazing safari jacket.
Man, I love me a safari jacket. Every now and then.
You're a big jacket guy.
Yeah, every now and then you'll see someone pop up in like an episode of Columbo or something wearing a matching safari jacket and pants combo. There's a fantastic, there's an episode with William Shatner where he's wearing like a powder blue safari jacket ensemble. Excellent.
Wow, amazing.
If I could put, I don't think I could pull off a safari coat, but I want to try.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, we'll have to find out one day.
Maybe.
Get this man a safari coat. You'll also find a paddy wagon full of mimes.
Yeah, I don't know. That's just like it's a complete nonsense thing that they threw in there.
Yeah, it's so stupid and out of nowhere, and I love it so much.
Yeah, it's like there's literally everything else in this movie. Why not that?
Yeah, why not? Absolutely, why not? You'll also find Japanese stereotypes.
Yeah, we hadn't quite moved past that yet.
There's a weird attitudes towards East Asian folks in this movie.
Yeah, it's a hangover from the 80s, I think, because it was that whole fear of Japanese businesses overtaking everything was still alive and well. That was such a weird. I mean. I guess technically I lived through it, but I was too young to really understand any of that stuff. But what an interesting thing. Because there clearly was like the influx of Japanese cars and Japanese electronics and stuff. And it's so interesting to see that there was like a pseudo panic that the Japanese were going to take over everything. Even in like Back to the Future 2, when they go into the future, Marty and Needles work for a Japanese company that's very very coded with this kind of joke. It's interesting.
Yeah, there's definitely a level of like fascination and also hostility.
Yeah.
Of like we're afraid of it, but also we think it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Do you ever see the movie Gung Ho?
No.
It's a tough one to watch these days. I think it's actually
oh boy,
it's actually pretty funny and it's actually not terrible, but it's about Michael Keaton bringing a odd couple situation, except instead of a clean guy and a dirty guy, it's an American car company and a Japanese car company, and race-based hilarity ensues.
Oh boy. God. Okay. You'll also find tuna noodle cheese product chowder surprise.
Yeah. I love a good cheese product joke.
Just like mother used to make.
Yep. With extra sherry.
Yeah. A meta movie review.
Yeah, there's breaking the fourth wall and then there's whatever this movie does. Like they just drive a truck through it.
Right. Like rejecting the belief in a fourth wall to begin with.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. A pod person pod.
Yeah. In the first movie, in the background at the Inventors Conference, there was the time machine from the movie The Time Machine just there. And in this one, we get Christopher Lee just for no reason walking out of the back room of the laboratory holding one of the pods from Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah, just Dr. Catheter and his pod.
Great name.
It's so good. You'll also find a Gremlin Marathon Man reference.
Yeah, you know, this is from the era of like the where the people making these things were throwing in jokes for them as much as they were throwing in jokes for anybody else. Like,
oh yeah,
I think that's the big difference with the classic seasons of The Simpsons. Is I'm pretty sure that I knew more about Citizen Kane from watching The Simpsons before I actually even saw the movie, because there were so many Citizen Kane jokes. And yeah, having the googly eyed gremlin become a dentist and throw in a "is it safe" line drop is pretty niche.
And last but certainly not least, you'll find Race Traitor Gizmo participating in a genocide of his own people.
Yeah, I think he needs to be taken to task and possibly arrested for war crimes.
You want a Nuremberg trial, Gizmo the Mogwai?
Yeah, I guess I don't really know who would put him on trial. Are the gremlins a people? Like, are there more out there? Are the Mogwai? We never get the answers. And you know what? I don't care.
I mean, the brainy gremlin does refer to them as an ethnic group. So
that's true. He does.
Yeah.
But in that in a nutshell is what is so fantastic about this movie is it's one of the few times, I think, where a sequel doesn't try at all to expand its lore or get into backstory. Because, like, if this I guarantee you, if Gremlins 1 had come out in 2000, right, and Gremlins 2 came out in 2005 or 2010 or whatever, I guarantee you Gremlins 2 would be like, well, what if we go back to where the gremlins are from?
Right.
It's like, I don't care. What I care about is gremlins doing crazy gremlin stuff, and that is what they give you in this movie.
Yeah, you just want to see some, like, gremlin on everyone violence.
Yeah, like, I want to see...
I want to see gremlin on gremlin violence, horrified. Gremlin on human violence.
I want to see Phoebe Cates horrified by a flasher gremlin.
Yeah. I forgot that the flasher gremlin comes back in this one and she kicks it across the room.
So good. Yeah, what are your feelings about this? Because every time I watch this movie, I like it more. I think when I saw it originally as a kid, I liked it because of its goofiness, but now as I watch it, I really appreciate how kind of smartly written the stupid stuff is. And I just think it's great. I think it's a fantastic sequel.
Yeah, I think it really can be tricky, though, if you are like me and you saw the original Gremlins first and, like, really liked it and have a lot of affection for it, and then you see this one, because they are extremely different movies.
Oh, like, yeah.
Even as they're kind of pulling some of the same gags and referring, like, you know, Gremlins 2 refers back to the original very regularly. But tonally, they're very different. What the movies are trying to do is very different, I think. And so it can be quite an adjustment coming from the original into this one if you're expecting that sort of, like, PG, PG-13 horror movie, like... You know, not super scary, but scary enough for your, like, 10-year-old niece or nephew or your, like, younger sibling.
Yeah. I remember when I first saw the original, after having watched this one so many times, I was shocked at how dark it was and how violent it was.
Yeah. Yeah. A bunch of people die in the original.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, there are several murders in the original Gremlins. And even though the town is smaller, the stakes feel much higher.
Yeah.
In my opinion. And so in this one, Gremlins 2 is not trying to do that again. It's very much leaning into the kind of more over the top and satirical elements and leaning way further into the comedic stuff, which, I mean, it absolutely works and it's a hilarious movie, but it's a shift from the original.
Yeah, it does. So I, years ago, jokingly said my one rule about a sequel, especially with monsters, is the monsters in the sequel, there can either be more of them or they can be stronger, but they can't be both because that's too hard. And I said it kind of as a joke, but I do actually believe that, because if you look at the way a lot of sequels play out, that is usually how it goes. There's either more of them and you can kill them easier, or it comes back and it's stronger. But if it was both, then there'd be no movie.
Right.
And this is an instance where there are definitely more of them, and the, you know, the gestation period has shortened way down. They're just getting as many out there as possible to amplify the mayhem. But I would say the solution at the end is, it's goofy, but it is so, like, I think one of the best things about this is actually how well it's set up in a, from the script phase, as far as setting things up that pay off later in the movie. And like, I don't think anybody watching this movie for the first time would have expected them to kill the gremlins by unleashing the electric gremlin from the hold, from being on hold on the phone. But it's great. Yeah. There's so much of that stuff in here that's just little bits that they set up that they pay off later in the movie, and they pay off really well.
Yeah, I mean, it is such an immensely cleverly done movie. Like, it's referencing back on itself, but it's also referencing other movies and other pieces of media, and it's kind of lampooning the whole, it's lampooning so many things. It's lampooning, like, Hollywood and the nature of sequels in general, and then it's also making fun of, like, consumerist urges and the sort of, like, small town naivete versus, like, the rude big city and all. And it's doing so many of those things all at the same time, and also very much refusing to take itself seriously, which I really appreciate. Like, I don't know. I think there could be a worse version of this movie that also tried to have some sort of, like, lesson at the end.
Yeah, yes.
You know, like I what you mentioned earlier, talking about Mr. Clamp, who originally was kind of conceived as the villain. I kind of like that they pivoted away from that ultimately, and that he is this sort of, like, well-meaning in a way, but, like, deeply out of touch with the rest of humanity figure.
It's way more interesting.
It is, and it sort of makes it so that this movie is not saying, like, rich city people are bad and small town people are good, or small town people are ignorant and city people are more savvy. Like, it's kind of not doing any of those things. It's just, like, it's making fun of everything all at the same time.
Yeah, and it allows a lot of that stuff to breathe, too. Like, you've got I think it's easy to go into this expecting Clamp to be fairly one note, and it's kind of refreshing to see. My favorite stuff with Clamp in this is when he is up in his penthouse.
Yeah.
And he's just, like, bored and he doesn't know what to do. And so
he's, like, pacing around.
And then he calls out to his secretary, and he's like, Ooh, let's take a memo. 'Cause he's got everything. And he's just kind of bored and doesn't know what else to do. And that's not, like, something that it's not a point they belabor or anything. It's just a nice little bit of character work. And once everything starts going to shit, he's actually, like, really into it, because he's got something to do. It allows him to try out his secret escape hatch or whatever. He's just he's a refreshing take on the billionaire industrialist type.
Yeah, and he finds the idea that he could be the one to save the city really appealing.
Sure, yeah.
Which I think is funny in that it's true. Like, we still see very rich people and billionaires who think they're going to quote unquote save the planet or save humanity or whatever. But rather than do things like make sure everybody has clean water or, you know, curing common communicable diseases, instead they're focused on like, I'm going to send everybody to space.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's colonize other planets. That'll be cool.
Yeah.
Let's build weird submarines. I'll build a weird submarine. Everybody's going to love it. And he is that character is exactly that guy, you know, like Mr. Clamp is building revolving doors that are automated, which is hilarious because the whole point of a revolving door is that once you push it, it like the momentum can carry it. Like, but it doesn't need a computer. It's very simple.
Those do exist now.
Oh, they do. Yeah.
And they work a lot better than they do in this, but
yeah. Clint, I was,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Just, I was giving my husband a hard time watching this movie because, I think he might work in this building. He has an elevator in his building. The elevators in his building do not have buttons.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think you just, like, tell it where you want to go.
That seems like a recipe for disaster.
And they're not allowed to have plants at their desk spaces because of potential aphid infestations.
Oh, hey, look at that.
I'm not kidding. It's true.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's funny how some of the stuff in this seems so excessive, but is kind of the way things go now. Like the barcode identification pin.
Mm-hmm.
That seems so ridiculous, but I mean, it's like, that's basically how everything, where everybody's got a key card, you know, to go in. Hopefully the people who run your department don't need to scan your key card to know what your name is, but.
Right. But like how much shit do we now do via like QR codes?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Shoot, what was I gonna say? Oh, and the PA system, the like automated building PA systems, like we have that now. With like, you know, the whole Amazon environment of voice activated assistants, but I absolutely love the PA announcements throughout this movie.
Yeah.
I think they are some of the funniest things I've ever heard. Like the one after she pulls the fire alarm.
Yes, yeah.
When it's like, fire, bringer of warmth and also destruction. Man's greatest tool as he built civilization. Fire. Yes, this building is on fire.
Yeah.
Everyone starts coming out of the office like, what the fuck?
So dense. Like, so much of that stuff
so funny.
Just blows right past you. Because while that is being said, there's like 12 other things happening on screen.
Yeah, that this movie is one that I feel like maybe this is going to make me sound a little bit like an old person, but I feel like at least I don't encounter as many movies that even attempt to be close to this in terms of that density, because like you were just saying, there's so much happening simultaneously in this movie. There's the PA announcements are happening, and at the same time, characters will be talking over the PA announcements, and they're moving the action forward, trying to get to, you know, whatever room or find Gizmo or do whatever they're doing. And then there are visual gags also happening kind of in the background or off to the side. And I feel like now, if you try to watch this movie now and you're on your phone half the time, you're missing.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So much of that stuff. And I think that assumption that your audience is going to be on their phones at least part of the movie is has discouraged people from making things that do have kind of unelaborated on visual gags, yeah, and like things that are just sort of happening and never commented on. Like, you either see it and you catch it, or you miss it. Yeah. That's it.
Well, what's interesting is sort of a precursor to that. The TV show Police Squad, which is where the Naked Gun movies comes from, that only lasted 6 episodes for exactly that reason, because at least that's what the creators said. They're like, well, when people watch TV, they're folding laundry, they're doing other stuff, and we made a show that you actually have to watch to get most of the jokes. And I think it shows exactly that they were right, in that the show didn't work, but the movies, where you are a captive audience looking at the screen, before this was before phones were existed in this way, in that way anyway, you get the jokes, and it's hilarious because you are focused in on the thing in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, talking about sequels, do you have any thoughts on what you look for in a sequel? Just generally? I think it's...
That is a very... It's a very good question.
I think it's a harder thing to do than a lot of people give it... will give credit for. Because...
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Because it's... You need to walk this line where... you're giving people more of the thing they like, but hopefully in a new way. And sometimes that can go horribly wrong.
Right. And you don't want to risk alienating your fans who loved the first thing you did by going too far in a different direction in the next one.
I will say, because that's just how I am, I do have a lot of respect for people who will actively alienate their audience in the sequel.
Yeah.
Like, I'm one of, like, the 5 people on the planet who actually really liked Joker 2 for exactly
really
that reason.
That. Yeah. Yeah, and I respect it when it's done with some sort of purpose in mind. Do you know what I mean? Like I haven't seen Joker 2, so I can't comment on that. Mm-hmm. But when you look at this movie, like I was saying at the top, it tonally and kind of thematically, they're very, very different.
Yeah.
As much as they are, you know, it references the first movie all the time. Characters return, they redo some gags, it's all there. But it is still a very different movie. But I think there's enough connective tissue that keeps this from being like a total fuck you to the audience.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit of a fuck you to, like, the studios.
Yeah, it's kind of... This one feels like a sequel that is... it's kind of like the more successful, broadly successful version of the Joker 2 kind of thing. Because, like, this was a movie where they had been trying... This comes out... 6 or 7 years after the original. So, and they had been trying to make it for a long time, and Joe Dante wasn't interested because he, you know, the first one was so taxing that he was like, I'd rather just do other stuff. And they had a bunch of, they just couldn't get it to work. And then finally he came back with one of the writers and they did this. And this very much feels like a, they asked me to make a sequel. I'm going to make a sequel. Studio be damned. You know, I think I saw an interview.
Right.
I think I saw an interview with him where he said, the studio said, if you can make it for X amount of dollars, do whatever you want. And which is exactly what he did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it kind of seems a little bit like once they kind of convinced him to make a sequel, he was like, well, now I'm going to make a sequel whether you like it or not.
Yeah, it almost feels like if the first one was in fact such a torture for him to do, this feels very cathartic because he is he's sending up criticisms of the movie. Apparently the scene where the mother is sort of yelling at the movie theater guy about how the movie's violent, that's actually a real criticism that he got at some point. The fact that he's doing the Leonard Maltin thing and the critic gets eaten by the by the gremlins. Even stuff from the first movie, they're totally taking the piss out of it. Like, I think one of my other favorite scenes in this, which doesn't make sense if you haven't seen the first movie, is when they start talking about President's Day. And then I can't remember the girl's name, but Phoebe Cates goes like, "Oh, don't talk about presidents." And then she goes into this insane story about a guy who looked exactly like Abe Lincoln, and which is them sending up the strange monologue she has in the first one about her father getting stuck in this chimney and dying dressed as Santa Claus.
Right, but whereas in the first one, she has this dramatic moment where in the middle of all the action, it gets quiet, and she has this big monologue about, you know, her dad trying to fake being Santa Claus and getting himself stuck in the chimney and dying. And one of the things I think, even when we covered that movie, that I kind of questioned is, how funny is this supposed to be?
Yeah.
Like, it's such a dark, because she gets all the way through it in the original, and then you, the audience, have to kind of sit with it, and the other characters around her have to sit with it and react to it in front of her face.
Yeah.
It's like dark and then awkward and then funny, but it shouldn't be funny in a way. Like, in universe, if this happened to her, you're like, oh no, ugh. Because it is such a dark tale, but in this, because they don't let her finish it, it's just funny.
And the story, like, she's telling is so much more insane.
Well, which is saying something, because the story in the original is insane,
right? Yeah.
And then it's just taking that same bit and cranking it up to 11, and then removing some of the ambiguity about whether or not you're allowed to laugh at it.
Yes.
Yeah.
go ahead.
I'm just still thinking about your question about what do I look for in a sequel, or, you know, what am I hoping for in a sequel? I think a lot of it comes down to, like, Hollywood, I guess, has been doing this for a very long time, but we're right now in a moment where the assumption is things are going to be given a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it's either it's going to be split into 2 to 3 movies, or it's going to become a series, or there's going to be some sort of follow-up to it. And I think sometimes it's not warranted. Like, I understand why Joe Dante was really hesitant to make a sequel to Gremlins, given that it was a successful film and felt like a very complete story, like, felt like it had a natural ending, and this tale of this creature and this boy has come to a close and we can move on now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, a successful sequel is something where it can really justify its existence. In some way.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is going to be an interesting question, I think, to come back to as we cover more and more examples of sequels in, like, different eras and different subgenres within horror.
Yeah. Yeah, I find it interesting to see sort of the journey that sequels have gone on in the past 40 years or so, because they've been making sequels to movies about as long as movies have existed, especially horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back and look at the, say, the Universal horror movies, they were sequels in that they involved the same monsters, but they weren't necessarily, there wasn't like a long running story or, you know, canon or anything like that.
Right.
You know, you've got Dracula, and the next one after that is Dracula's Daughter, where instead of, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but
no,
It's actually pretty interesting because it's sort of an adaptation of you know the vampire story Carmilla.
Oh yeah,
it's sort of an adaptation of that, but it's widely regarded as like the first lesbian vampire movie.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that movie starts with, it picks up exactly from the end of the first Dracula, where the cops show up and arrest Abraham Van Helsing for murder.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And then Dracula's daughter shows up and I forget what the rest of the movie is, but like,
this man killed my father.
Yeah, basically. It's like two cops show up at Dracula's castle and they're like, what's going on in here? And he's like, I just drove a stake through the heart of this monster. He's like, oh, so you killed a man, did you?
Yeah.
He's like, what? No, I saved the world.
Yeah.
And then, but then the rest of the movie really doesn't have anything to do with anything. And then from that point, all the movies they do with Dracula, it turns into the thing where it's like, oh, yeah, Dracula's back. How is he back? Doesn't matter. He's just here.
Yep.
And he's doing his thing. Same with Frankenstein. Frankenstein's a little bit... Anyway, my point is...
Yeah.
As time has gone on, things have become a little bit more... The through line has become more necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that is for the better, because...
Yeah.
You run into these problems now where they're making these movies with an eye on the sequel before they even finish it. And so you end up, in order to do that, you kind of don't really get to tell a full story. Like, because one of the ones that stands out to me as fascinating from a sequel standpoint is Ghostbusters 2.
Mm.
Because Ghostbusters 2... which is widely regarded as a terrible movie. I like it quite a bit, but it is beat for beat almost exactly the first movie with like a couple details shifted around, right? And with that in particular, you've got a story that is an underdog story about underdogs who then have to prevail at the end of your story, right? And so when you pick up the sequel... One of the things you have to do is put them back into an underdog position.
Yeah.
Which anytime they have to do that tends to be very awkward and just like doesn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of
feels
the,
manufactured.
Yeah. It's sort of the Star Wars problem that they had when they did the sequels to Star Wars, where, you know, Return of the Jedi ends with everybody happy and dancing Ewoks and the Empire's gone. And then when they do Force Awakens, well, you can't just have them all happy and just hanging out together. You know, they have to have something to overcome, which is
why
Han and Leia have broken up and Luke has gone off and done whatever he's doing. So you have to kind of reset the board. And I think the other way you can handle it is to do something like this, where you just completely blow the whole thing up and try to get at the thing people liked about the first one and just amplify that as much as possible.
Yeah, and then I think, you know, not to get too far off topic, the other kind of category of sequels are, you know, we mentioned before we started recording this, we were talking about the Ty West, like the X trilogy. And I think that's a really great example of like sequels done well.
Yeah.
Where I don't want to, you know, I haven't done any research on those movies, so I don't want to, you know, totally talk out of my ass about it. But my sense from just watching them is that he knew he was going somewhere. Like, he had a story or a set of stories centered around one or maybe two characters that he knew he wanted to tell. And there's a bit of an arc that feels, whether it was fully planned out or not, it makes sense altogether the way it's told in kind of these three large chapters of, you know, having each movie be a big piece of this narrative. And I think that can really work if you if you know kind of where you're starting and you know where you're ending, I think that can be done well. It can also be done very poorly. But I think it's a lot harder when either, like you were saying, there's either movies like, Gremlins or Ghostbusters, where it doesn't necessarily feel like they made those movies thinking about, well, what are we going to do for the sequel, like, right away?
Yeah.
Like, they didn't have a plan in place of, like, all right, movie one is going to show us this, and then movie two is going to show us that.
Yeah.
Instead, it was like, oh, shit, that movie did really well. Let's do another one.
I'm honestly, I think they would have done this if Joe Dante hadn't come back. But I'm a little bit shocked that they used the same human characters from the first one, as far as Billy and I can't remember her name.
Kate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if Joe Dante hadn't been involved and they had gone a different direction, I think it would have been like, well, someone else ends up with Gizmo and we do the whole whole thing again. But this time it's different characters and it's like, I don't know, in Las Vegas or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's,
yeah,
I think it would be an easy series to, I'm a little surprised that we haven't had 7 Gremlins movies that went straight to video after the second one, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it absolutely feels like, a property that is ripe for that kind of thing, where you can just have anyone discover a Mogwai,
right? Yeah,
anywhere in the world, like you really could. And it's, the rules are like a little convoluted, but there's only 3 of them, and it's pretty easy to convey them. Like, they're pretty short. Like, don't get them wet. Don't feed them after midnight. Don't put them in the sun.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which even that. They very smartly make fun of by asking all the questions that I think anyone who has ever watched this movie a Gremlins movie in the past 40 years asks, which is, well, what if he's on a plane and he crosses
the date line?
What if he's got a caraway seed stuck in his teeth and he swallows it after midnight? But as the man said, we could have had Gremlins 6 and Gremlins 7. Instead, we got COVID and 9/11.
Well, you know that isn't Gremlins 3 coming out in like 2027?
It is. Even though there has already been a Gremlins 3. It's called Gremlins 3: Dawn of Desmond. And it's a film where Gizmo becomes a gremlin who teaches the other gremlins about democracy and philosophy. They develop a country. They name it Gremlin Nation.
Oh,
they ban all immigration. They have genocidal tendencies. Gizmo isn't into it. Also, he has a kid with a human woman played by Jennifer Aniston. So, your move, Spielberg.
Anyway, boy.
So, getting into the actual meat of this movie a little bit, because I feel like we've been sort of dancing around it. Let's talk about the gremlins themselves.
Yes.
One of the things from my childhood is that the spider gremlin scared the shit out of me. For a very long time.
Yeah, fair.
Do you have a favorite gremlin?
Huh.
I feel like they're easier to track in this one because they're so ridiculous. In the first one, they're just sort of... There's sort of the head bad guy gremlin. And then they all just kind of cause mayhem. But this one, they're all very... They're all very action figure coded, which is... kind of funny because I don't know if they made toys out of these at the time. They have since, but I don't know if they did at the time.
Yeah, I think I have an affection for the Bat Gremlin.
Yeah, I always really like the Bat Gremlin.
I just think it's like a cool design and it's a fun idea. And like the bit where he gets cement poured on him and then he just becomes a gargoyle is really funny to me.
Yep. I also like it that they use the Bat Gremlin to have Dick Miller's characters get some catharsis after the first movie.
Yeah. Yeah, he gets to like literally fight his demons.
Yeah, because he shows up and he's been like, he's got PTSD from the first movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like the Bat Gremlin. I don't like the Spider Gremlin, but I like the kind of head evil gremlin before he becomes the Spider Gremlin. Mm-hmm.
Incredible. The Spider Gremlin is an incredible design. That's an amazing animatronic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it looks disgusting and horrifying and therefore great, but mm-hmm. I am similar to you. I do not love the spiders.
Yeah.
Getting better about it. But I'm very glad I didn't see this movie as a child, because that gremlin would have given me nightmares as well.
Yes. Where do you stand on sexy lady gremlin?
I kind of love her. even though it's very much like a product of its time, I think it knows it is. I think it's like spoofing that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But like, she's so over the top and just weird. Like, she's so off-putting to the humans.
Yes.
Which I kind of love. And she's definitely like, you know, quote unquote sexy, right? Like, mm-hmm. she's always her
lips are like, just kind of disturbing.
They're super disturbing, and she's got gremlin boobs, and she's in like gremlin high heels and the whole nine yards. But I think the hyper femininity on a gremlin is just like very, very funny, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways.
The ending
with the lady gremlin is absolutely just, yes. always like sends me over the edge at the very end of this movie.
The thing that has always disturbed me about the lady gremlin is like the little kissy noises that she's constantly making, where it's like constantly like, like the cooing and stuff. It's so weird. Yeah. It's so creepy.
It's so fucking creepy, but I kind of love it because it is so off-putting, and like every human in this movie who runs into her is absolutely horrified, like more freaked out by her than they are by a standard gremlin, which I just find very, very funny.
Well, I think they clearly set the tone for the movie in that opening Looney Tunes thing, because this whole movie is a giant Looney Tunes cartoon basically, and I always kind of read the lady gremlin as sort of like either when Bugs Bunny dresses up in drag, or do you remember in Who Framed Roger Rabbit when Bob Hoskins gets kissed by what he thinks is Jessica Rabbit, but it's that one crazy lady tune that's like, "It's a man."
Yeah.
Like it kind of reads like that sort of a little bit. So it definitely feels like a cartoon.
Oh yeah. Yeah, 100%. And there's the sort of like drag coded or like monstrous feminine thing. It people find it upsetting and funny because it is that like hyper exaggerated femininity that is either played for laughs or played to like freak out straight men a lot, where it is like a wig and lipstick on a horrible lizard creature. Like it's supposed to push all those buttons of like taking things that, you know, mostly straight men are supposed to find very alluring, you know, this very dolled up, the hypersexual like sex characteristics of like the gremlin boobs and the little, like she's got a little waist and her calves are all like tighter than the male gremlins because she's in high heels and she's got a butt and things like that, and of like those big lips. It's all like those ultra exaggerated feminine features to kind of just like extra freak people out, which I think it works. I think it's also really funny.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. And it, I mean, even as you're saying, the final sequence with her and Robert Picardo is, again, it's very Looney Tunes. It feels like a Pepe Le Pew cartoon or something. And he's got the kisses all over his face. It's great.
I find that ending so funny and so immensely fucked up, yeah. Because it just like zooms in slowly on his face, mm-hmm. and as she's getting closer and the kissy noises are getting louder, he sort of makes a like, you know what?
Yeah.
Actually, all right.
Like, so. He's moving past his prejudices.
Yeah. That's where your Gremlins 3 guy should have come from.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Ooh. There's the human gremlin pairing, yeah, that someone should have told that Nick you were asking for. That. Yeah. who's your favorite gremlin? Beside the spider gremlin, of course.
I've always been kind of partial to the dumb ones.
Yeah.
Like the one that I've always liked the one, because there's the googly eye one, but then there's another one who's, yeah, just a dumbass with like the one big tooth in his mouth.
Yeah.
Where like at a certain point, he just like looks at someone and goes, oh.
Yeah.
I always liked that guy. But I've always liked, because I think it's another one that kind of creeped me out, the vegetable gremlin.
Yeah.
It's so weird. And like, it's... This is 1990. We're right at the tail end of the golden age of practical effects and animatronics and stuff. And this movie, the effects in this movie are so good. Like the gremlin turning into vegetable gremlin, where those vegetables are just bursting out of his face. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah.
And each one of these gremlins being like, very clearly designed, at least the ones that you see more than the other ones, very clearly designed. They all have character just by looking at them. My biggest fear of them doing another Gremlins movie is that the gremlins are going to be all CGI, and it's not going to work as well, because it's like part of the magic is that these things are slimy and goopy and physical. I just don't think it's going to work as well.
Yeah, I think if you know, if they were to go in the CGI direction, it would be very unfortunate, because I do think those physical properties and the idea, when you're watching these movies, just by looking at the gremlins, you can kind of imagine what it would feel like to touch them.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much texture involved, like, in their skin. They have, like, scales and ridges and bumps, and they're slimy, and they've got claws, and you know what I mean? Like, there's so much about them visually that just immediately puts you in the mind of, like, ugh, what would it be like to touch that?
Yeah.
In the same way that the Mogwai are the opposite, where they're these little, cute, furry, like... ancestors to the Labubu, like they seem like they'd just be so soft and like warm and cuddly, and so like you want to touch them because they seem like they'd be almost like holding a kitten. And then on the flip side, you look at the gremlins and it's just like, ooh, yeah, no, that looks like touching a slimy alligator.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest losses to movie monsters in the switch to CGI is the severe reduction in slime, because the slime is what makes those things work in any movie from the 80s that has a monster in it. The thing that makes it work is the fact that they drench it in like KY jelly or whatever the fuck they're using, because the light hits it and it looks cool. Like, I think that's just a big problem,
covered in lube.
Yeah, I think that's a big problem now, because when you see a movie that has a practical monster in it, I think one of the reasons why they look fake now is because they're not slimy enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I buy it. I think it definitely could be a contributing factor.
we did talk about the Hulk Hogan scene for a second. So,
okay.
When we were talking before, we said this movie kind of obliterates the fourth wall, or doesn't believe in the concept of the fourth wall. It's... Not only do they have a scene where Leonard Maltin reviews the video cassette release of the first movie, but they also have this bit that is kind of sort of taken from like William Castle kind of thing, like The Tingler, where if you've ever seen if you've ever seen The Tingler, The Tingler is a movie about a creature that feeds off of screams, or only screaming can stop it. I can't remember. And it attaches itself to your spine. It's you should watch it. It's good. And halfway through the movie, they lose the Tingler, and Vincent Price basically like turns to the screen, looks at the crowd, and says, "It's loose in the theater. Everybody scream, or it's gonna get you."
Yeah.
And so they were trying to do something similar to that, where they have this film you're watching, Gremlins 2, all of a sudden rip and burn.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretically caused by the gremlins, which then goes into
a making like shadow puppets.
I love the shadow puppets thing when he turns into Abe Lincoln and
just to torment Kate.
And then from that point, we go back into, I don't know what universe this is now, where someone comes out of a movie theater to complain that Gremlins 2 has the film has broken.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy in the projection booth comes down and he's like, "There's gremlins in the projection booth." So then the usher goes into he's like, I know who can fix this. And he goes into the theater to find Hulk Hogan, who then gets up and cuts a promo on the gremlins.
Yeah.
And then says, "Sorry, folks.
The gremlins.
Sorry, folks. This won't happen again. Enjoy the movie." And then they go back to Gremlins 2.
Yeah.
It's one of the more insane things I've ever seen.
It really like when you said that Joe Dante kind of agreed to do this movie with the agreement that he could kind of do whatever he wanted, that he got to have full creative control, I was like, that is the only way something like that made it into a movie in the year 1990.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's totally like, unhinged, but it's also...
So unhinged.
It's unhinged, but it's like... It's just so... It's... I this movie is unhinged, yes, but Joe Dante, I think, is such a good filmmaker that I never feel like it's out of control. Like, it always feels like he knows exactly what he's doing.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's rare, because I think a movie like this could very easily get away from whoever was making it.
Oh, yeah. It never feels like he's just throwing more shit on top of everything just to have more shit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it feels very like I'm pushing things as far as I can push them, but I'm doing that on purpose.
Yeah. And I think that's part of why the movie's so well written, because it's got so much random shit in it, but the underpinning of that is actually a pretty solid structure.
Yeah.
So they can hit the beats they have to hit to pay off the things they've set up, but in those spaces in between, they can go completely insane.
Yeah.
And I mean,
will and do.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I would agree with whoever said it. The plot is, don't let the gremlins get out. That's the entire plot of the movie.
Yeah. Yep.
But inside that, they've got so many satisfying character arcs, like Robert Prosky as Dracula, who wants to get out
Fred.
Of being, who wants to get out of being a shitty horror host. And he manages to do that by being the man on the ground doing news coverage inside the building.
Yeah.
As Dracula. Yeah, it's incredible.
Yes. In the full traditional Bela Lugosi style Dracula outfit with his new cameraman, who is the like tourist that a lot of the Japanese stereotypes were pointed at. Yep. God, there was I had something and I lost it. Damn it.
I want to talk about Christopher Lee.
Please, I always want to talk about Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee made a lot of movies. Christopher Lee made a lot of bad movies. Christopher Lee, never bad in a movie.
Yes, correct.
He is if there's anybody in this movie where you, if you looked at the cast list, if there's anyone who you'd go, I bet he's not really game for this. Christopher Lee, I think, would be the person most people would point at, because he seems so uptight and British, but man, he is so good in this movie.
He is amazing. Like, he's always amazing, but him playing the sort of mad scientist character up in Splice of Life is just like every word out of his mouth, every scene he's in, he absolutely steals it.
Yeah.
I love when he first gets introduced and he's getting the delivery of diseases, and he thinks it's going to be like, I don't know, the flu or something.
Right,
and then
yeah.
instead it's rabies, and he goes, well, I've already got rabies.
Yes.
And it's so deadpan. It's so serious. When he starts trying to negotiate with the gremlins and he's like, I can get you diseases.
Yes. You'd like that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And even in that first scene with he's getting the diseases delivered and he doesn't get what he wants, then he turns to Julia Sweeney after she blows her nose and he's like, can I have that? Or
yeah.
whatever he says.
Right, like, and there's no sense of, like, what the fuck they're actually doing.
Yeah.
Like, there's his weird twin or maybe clone assistants in the lab who are making electrified mice and, like, brain juice hormones or whatever. But it's just so absurd and like amazing, but again, like, weirdly prescient that you would have these, like, I mean, now we just refer to them as biotech companies, right?
Yeah.
Like, working in office buildings. That's half of the companies around the Boston area at this point. It's just like medical and biotech companies in these nondescript office buildings that have like an ice cream shop and a coffee shop in the lobby. And then like a real estate office on floor 7, and then up on floor 18 is where they have the smallpox on ice.
Yeah. I guess, you know, I don't know if I entirely appreciated that until we're talking about it now, but yeah, it is because it always seemed to me as, man, what a crazy building to have all this kind of different, like, what is this building? What, it's got a juice bar and a television studio and the lab and stuff. It just seems so ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, anytime I have to go to the doctor, or like if I go to a doctor, I walk into an office park and it's like, here's the physical therapy place. Here's the place where we make chocolate. Here's the point, you know, it's just all of these completely random things that are in this space, very nondescript space.
Yeah. And from the outside, you can't tell. And
right,
even when you're in the building, if you work on one of the other floors, you're just like, well, I don't know.
My
job's on floor 6. I don't know what happens up on floor 12.
Yeah. When you go in there and you look at that directory to find out what floor your doctor's office is on, some of the shit on that thing, it's like law offices, cryogenic freezing places, and
yeah,
a place where they make claw games.
Claw games.
I would go to that
place.
Amazing.
That
would be pretty good.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, Christopher Lee's incredible. Do you like Gizmo in this?
Weirdly, like, not as much as I do in the first one.
Yeah, he doesn't have a ton to do. And
I think that's part of the problem, maybe. And like, I don't know. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's funny. Again, I think this is something that only gets done this way without studio interference. But I feel like a studio would say, people love Gizmo. We need more Gizmo. How do we make this story more about Gizmo? Whereas Joe Dante and the writer realized that Gizmo is not the interesting thing about this concept.
Right.
It's not called Gizmo and the Gremlins. Maybe the cartoon is, but it's called Gremlins because the Gremlins are the fun part. Gizmo is just the delivery mechanism.
delivery mechanism. Yeah, and there's something like in the first one, Gizmo is like so cute and innocent and lost.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems a little more like a, I don't know, like a little more like a child or a baby.
Yeah.
Do you know what I, whereas in this one, like he talks more, but you're right. There's not a lot for him to do, or he doesn't really get connected back with the other main characters for a lot of the movie.
Yeah.
For most of it, he's like at the mercy of the other.
Yeah.
Of the gremlins. Yes. Yeah.
He has time while everything else is going to shit to get in a workout session and pump some iron before he turns into Rambo.
Yeah, the Mogwai training montage.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think as you were saying before, Gizmo's best function in the Gremlin story is kind of as a misdirect because he is presented as this cuddly, cute thing to see what comes out of him being so monstrous is kind of a surprise in the first one. This one, you know what you're getting as soon as you sit down to watch this movie for the most part. Well, you think you do, and then you watch this movie and you say, I was not expecting any of that.
But you do understand the mechanics of how the gremlins come about.
Yeah. But so in this one, I don't know. Unless you try to give him like a plot, which I don't think anybody wants, he just is kind of in the background until he learns how to shoot a bow and arrow and blow up toy cars or whatever he's doing.
Yeah. How do you feel about the brainy gremlin?
I like him. I've
period. End of statement.
Yeah, I've always thought his voice is so insane that whatever that accent that Tony Randall's doing, like the mid-Atlantic smart guy accent, is very good. And I think that's probably, if you want to go for like gremlin lore expansion, I think that's probably where you're going to get it, because he starts talking about basically how they just want like equal rights or something.
Yeah. they want civilization.
Yes, that's what they want.
Yes. One of my favorite bits with the brainy gremlin is during that speech that he gives on Fred's impromptu talk show that they set up.
Mm-hmm.
Is when Grandpa Fred has asked, what is it that you creatures want? And he starts expounding on how they want civilization but do not yet have it.
Mm-hmm.
How he just all of a sudden turns and shoots another gremlin in the face with a gun.
Yes.
And then is like, see, that wasn't very civilized. It was fun, but it wasn't very civilized.
Yeah. I think they use him just the right amount. There's another movie where they try to give him some sort of like more business to do or more like more of a plot where I think they managed to keep him in the pocket of being, he's the smart brainy gremlin, but he's still just talking about chaotic bullshit. Like he's not actually using his newfound intelligence to do anything productive. He's still just being a crazy gremlin.
Right. Like he doesn't become like authoritarian dictator gremlin who's like organizing and making them all into like an orderly army.
Right.
To, you know, lay siege to the city or whatever. He still loves the chaos. He's still just as batshit insane as the other gremlins. He can just tell you more about it.
Yeah.
But like wants the same things, which is just, I don't know, violence and snacks, which sounds pretty great to me, actually.
if they are making a third one, I'd like to see a socialist gremlin who just spends the entire movie trying to get them to unionize.
I feel like they probably would do that at this point.
Yeah, it'd be pretty good. Oh, I almost forgot about Phantom of the Opera gremlin, where they do the entire unmasking scene from Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
And I was very happy. I don't know why I ever doubted Joe Dante here, but they do it correctly too, where they do the cut to the front of the Phantom as she reaches over and pulls, then he makes the big like ah face and then turns around and points at her. It's great.
And gets like closer and closer to the camera too, so his face takes up the whole thing.
Yeah. Gremlins.
Oh, that's so good.
I mean, I don't know what else to say. Gremlins 2. I guess this is something we should talk about at the end of every episode here. Do you think this is a good sequel?
I do. I definitely think it's a good sequel. I think if you asked me, do I think it surpasses the original? Personally, I would say no.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you disagree with me on that point.
I don't know. I think it's a great sequel. I think one of the things that makes it great is that they were smart enough to realize that the only way they could do this again and have it not just feel repetitive would be to zig instead of zag, you know, where they do something different or take it down a different road, which I always appreciate because I'd rather they do something different and weird than just do the same thing. And they kind of do this.
Yeah.
It's like like I was saying before, they walk the line really well in this because technically they are just doing the same thing they did from the first one. But but it's been the scope and the escalation has been increased like 1,000-fold, whether it's the gremlins themselves or the environment they're in. It's just it feels like something different.
Yeah, and it's funny, as we've been talking about this, I've been having light flashbacks to our long ago coverage of all of the Friday the 13th movies.
You still haven't recovered yet.
I have not. I will not ever. I'm changed permanently. but in those, like, we got to a point where in sort of the middle movies of that series, things started to get so muddled.
Yeah.
Because there were a bunch of those middle sequels that just feel like they are copies of each other or could be basically interchangeable in like huge swaths of the movie.
Yeah.
That when we got to some of the later Friday the 13th stuff where it went truly insane, it was a relief because at least it was distinct. Like, it was, you know, like, we were like, wait, was that from 6 or 7? Maybe that one was from 4? I don't remember. And then we got to some of the insane stuff, and it was like, oh, yeah, we're going to send him to space now. Yeah. Great.
Yeah, I think that's a part one of the reasons I love Friday the 13th Part 7 so much is because it's like, well, what else are we going to have him do? I don't know, have him fight someone with mental powers and turn him into a zombie? Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, at least, you got to do at least something. They're doing something just different. Take a swing. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I think this is a great sequel. It's a movie that I find I feel like it's difficult to not have fun watching this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's those are my final thoughts. Would you put it on our list, our main list?
I would not. Just because I don't really think this is a horror movie.
No, it's not.
You know, like, sure, there are these kind of inexplicable, gross creatures that are coming to wreak havoc and destruction, but I don't know. They're not even quite as violent as they were in the first one. Like, they're still violent, but, like, I feel like the violence is so much more cartoony and slapstick that it doesn't feel as threatening as they were in the original.
Yeah.
So I just don't find them as scary in this one. So I wouldn't put it on our list, but only because of genre parameters.
Yeah, I would agree.
What about you?
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
It makes me want to see the sequel to the movie Megan. Did you see Megan, the first one?
I did, yeah.
What would you think of it?
I liked it. Yeah. I thought it was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
I don't think it was like I kind of don't get why it took off the way it did.
Yeah, I think it's just the dancing and stuff just became like a meme or whatever. But
yeah.
So yeah, I thought it was good enough. And then when I saw what they were doing with the sequel, I was kind of like, I feel like they're pulling a Gremlins 2 here, where they don't really know what to do other than just doing the same thing over again, so they're just going to just go nuts with it. And it kind of makes me want to see it after watching this, because I'm like, you know, I think I'd like to see someone else who can pull this off, where they realize they have to kind of take a left turn and see if they can get it to work.
Well, you are now one of the five people who is self-avowed a fan of movies, sequels that like to alienate the original audience.
That's true.
So
that's true.
Maybe you love it.
I might. Yeah. I look stupid when I saw the trailer, but, you know, maybe that's exactly what I needed to be.
Yeah, true.
All right. That's going to do it for Gremlins 2. However, this being the the first episode of our new series, we do have 11 other films to cover this year. And so
we are
going to tell you, the listener, what those films are. So what you can expect from us this year on Rotten Horror Picture Show Patreon: Gremlins 2, Exorcist 3, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, Final Destination 2, 28 Years Later, Scream 4, Alien Romulus, Psycho 2, Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, The First Omen, and Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed.
Yes.
We have done, I think, the only sequels on this list that we have not done the original films for are Final Destination, The Omen, and The Hammer Frankenstein. Is it The Horror Frankenstein? No. Curse of Frankenstein. So we will do those before we cover the sequels, just because, you know, it'd be easy to bang those out. Now, Amanda.
Yeah? Yes, Clay.
Pick a number between 2 and 12. I guess I shouldn't have just read them all in order.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully you weren't paying attention.
I was going to say, I have to pick one kind of in the middle, because I do sort of remember where we started and where we're ending. Let's go with 9.
Ooh, excellent. 9. Dracula Has Risen from the Grave will be our February film. It is my favorite of the Hammer Dracula movies.
Nice.
I don't know if it's technically the best one, but it is my favorite one. And I'm very much looking forward to talking about that. So,
cool.
That's going to do it for Gremlins 2. Amanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Clay.
Thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for supporting the show. And we will see you next time.
As the Clamp Center Tower would say, have a powerful day.